Hello, welcome to The Lancet Voice. It's June 2022, I'm Gavin Cleaver, and I'm here as ever with my co-host Jessamy Baginall. We're talking today about HIV and mental ill health as conditions that can exacerbate each other. Poor mental health can contribute to HIV risk and affect care outcomes, and living with HIV, or the risk of HIV, can contribute to poor mental health. A new series of papers in three Lancet journals, that's The Lancet HIV, The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health, and The Lancet Psychiatry, examine different aspects of the interplay between these two conditions among different key populations. To find out more about these populations, about intersectionality, mental health and HIV, and how integrating mental health into HIV services can have very positive outcomes, I spoke to Editor-in-Chief of The Lancet HIV, Peter Haywood. If after this you'd like to read the papers, you can find them on thelancet.com, and I've also put the link to the papers in the show notes, so you can just click through as well. So here's me and Jessamy talking to Peter Haywood. All right, so Peter Haywood, Editor-in-Chief of The Lancet HIV. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about a new series in collaboration with two other Lancet journals, The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health and The Lancet Psychiatry. Tell us a little bit about this series, you know, how it came about, where the idea came from.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on to talk about the series. The idea for the series really came about last year, and I thought I'd really like to work with The Lancet Psychiatry. You know, mental health and HIV are two fields that are really linked, but we haven't done that much about in the past. We've had a couple of bits of research, but I really thought it'd be great to explore the possibility of working with The Lancet Psychiatry, as I say. So I started talking with the editor, Niall, there about the possibility. And we came up with the idea of doing a series that would look at how HIV and mental health services could be aligned and could to benefit the populations affected. And to do that, our initial idea was to have two papers looking at specific populations and their populations affected by HIV and their mental health needs. So we were going to do a paper on substance users that would be published in The Lancet Psychiatry, and a paper on adolescents that would be published in The Lancet HIV. But when I started investigating the adolescents paper and who might write that, I kept finding myself looking at resources in The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health. So then I thought, oh, well, you know, let's see if they want to get involved as well. So approached the editor of The Lancet Child and Adolescent Health, Jane, to see if she would like to get involved. And yeah, she did. And so then we expanded the series to include three populations, adolescents, substance users, and the men who have sex with men. And these are all three populations that bear a particular disproportionate burden of HIV and have specific mental health needs. We limited it to three papers because although there are other populations that would be very interesting to cover, if we'd expanded it to more papers than that, we'd have inevitably ended up repeating some of the messages and the overlap would have been too great.
It's interesting that you talk about, you know, your kind of desire to work with The Lancet Psychiatry and how there wasn't a huge amount of overlap between published works between Lancet HIV and Lancet Psychiatry, because I feel like that's a kind of key of the series, you know, this kind of lack of alignment between HIV services and mental health services.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is, I mean, it's recognised. We haven't sort of invented some new field here. There's a lot of people who do work on this. But there really is, I mean, there is a need for better alignment. There's certainly so much more that could be achieved by people thinking about this a bit more and thinking about the opportunities that healthcare contacts, whether they're mental health contacts or contacts to support people with their HIV, how actually bringing in sort of thinking about mental health or bringing in HIV across the two fields could really help to improve the care and help to get people the right services that they need, whether there's mental health services for people living with HIV or HIV services for people who have mental ill health problems.
So there is a kind of, I saw in the series as well, there's kind of a disproportionate burden of HIV among people who have mental health issues.
I mean, it's sort of a huge, it's complex interaction going on there, and it varies for different populations. How these things work, but broadly having mental health issues can increase your risk of HIV. It can also, if you're living with HIV, having mental health problems can limit your ability to manage the disease. So, for example, you might not access the HIV care that you need. You might be on treatments, but you might have trouble being adherent to the treatment, which then means you suffer ill effects from your HIV, from HIV infection.
Yeah, I was interested to see it sort of framed as a syndemic, the sort of interaction between mental health and HIV. And I wondered whether you could just sort of unpack it a bit for us and describe what that really means and how it happens.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's particularly in the paper on Men Who Have Sex With Men, where they go into the idea of mental ill health and HIV being a syndemic. Now, syndemic theory is the idea that two or more conditions co-occur at high prevalence and interact with each other in a way that reinforces that co-occurrence and synergistically affects the outcomes of those conditions. So for Men Who Have Sex With Men, As I mentioned previously, mental health can contribute to HIV risk and make people more prone to adverse HIV outcomes. But then living with HIV or being at risk of HIV can impose a mental health burden on people. So you've really got these two things reinforcing each other.
Yeah.
And then for Men Who Have Sex With Men, on top of that interaction between mental ill health and HIV burden, there's also other pressures related to, you know, stigma, discrimination, marginalization, in some cases, criminalization of their lifestyles and identities. And it's not just limited to Men Who Have Sex With Men. I think sort of you can view it as HIV and mental ill health as a syndemic for other populations as well.
I think that's right, isn't it? And there's a real intersectionality about it, where people who, you know, are from marginalised community are impacted and affected even more. And, you know, the comments, they look at sort of pregnant adolescents, people experiencing homelessness, and female sex workers. It's complicated, those different contexts, but I suppose there must be a sort of overriding or, you know, common themes throughout.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the point about intersectionality is so important. There is, I think, each of the papers highlights and the comments that we have as well, they all highlight the many, many sort of layers and factors that contribute to the interactions between HIV and mental ill health. And it's really complicated, and each population is different. But what is common is that there are this intersectionality, all these different factors that contribute to this. For example, adolescents have particular mental health needs in relation to HIV. But then if, you know, a young woman becomes pregnant, that introduces a whole other range of issues. Sex workers might have specific needs, but then trans sex workers have those needs, but then others as well. And for some of the most marginalized people, sex workers, homeless people, etc., considering appropriate interventions is really important, but actually just getting care contact might be the first major hurdle for people facing barriers imposed. But that's why it's so important to think about the co-occurrence of HIV and mental health, and why, if services can be aligned in some way, any health contact can then be optimised. And this becomes particularly important, I think, in resource-limited settings where donor organisations fund HIV care, but actually psychiatric care is really lacking. So I think there's an opportunity, a real opportunity there.
Oh, yeah, and I wonder if we could just dig into this sort of adolescent issue, because there's a whole paper on adolescents and kind of, you know, with HIV and their sort of particular risk of mental health issues. I mean, well, maybe you could just expand on that a bit for us and think about, like, take us through some of the different reasons that happens and what it means. And I suppose also how it relates into some of our other work in terms of adolescence being this very important time in people's life for health in terms of setting up healthy behaviours and sort of lifestyle for the rest of their adult lives.
Yeah, so just before I answer the question, I just wanted to point out that the vast majority of adolescents living with HIV are in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
And the mental health problems that affect adolescents really encompass internalizing and externalizing disorders, mood disorders, emotional distress, cognitive disability, and substance misuse. And as the authors of the the paper in the series, Lucy Cleaver and Lorraine Scherer and colleagues point out, studies show that one in four adolescents living with HIV meets criteria for having a psychiatric condition. And that's huge. And that's, as I say, predominantly based in sub-Saharan Africa. The reasons behind mental ill health amongst adolescents can vary, obviously. For those adolescents who were infected vertically, so they've had HIV since birth, there can be a biological impact of the virus and the infection and treatment that might lead to psychiatric illness. But then all adolescents, because as you rightly say, adolescence is such a pivotal time for people's health, living with HIV can really have impacts related to their interactions with people around them, for example. So adolescents living with HIV might experience bullying and other stigma. Also, adolescents, because of the historic high burden of HIV and the impact that's had in sub-Saharan Africa, often adolescents living with HIV might have lost family members, which can contribute to mental ill health. And also, you know, there's a high burden of abuse experienced by adolescents living with HIV from their carers and family. So all of this really, you know, can contribute to a high burden of mental health amongst adolescents. And actually, on top of that, it's worth mentioning that over the past 2 years, the COVID pandemic has been particularly hard on young people and particularly challenging for them, with concerns about schooling and isolation and so on. And so that also contributes to this burden amongst that population.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you mentioned stigmatization there, because of course we can think of this in one way as, you know, the kind of mental burden of having to deal with a kind of a lifetime condition. But also stigmatization and bullying must play a huge part in this as well.
Yeah. I mean, stigma and bullying for adolescents and stigma and discrimination is a huge, huge issue. I think for all these populations, particularly for adolescents. But as I mentioned, you know, I mean, substance users may be excluded. You know, excluded because of you know, the legal environment, and also in many places, you know, with high burdens of HIV, there are still laws that criminalize same-sex behavior as well. So, stigma is one of the biggest issues, and is something that needs to be tackled. It's a real barrier to care for many of the populations we consider, and is really one of the things that first needs to be addressed to be able to make the most of any service alignment and this sort of cooperation.
Can I just ask a question about this? And there's not going to be a right answer, but it's just something that you always sort of feel a bit concerned about when you listen to these stories and you pathologize the mental health aspect, but actually their response is to trauma, presumably. You know, the trauma of being diagnosed with HIV early, of being having stigma, of being abused, you know, all of these other risk factors that they have. Is there a risk in pathologizing this as mental health? I mean, obviously we need to provide them, you know, the services and support that they need, but do you know what I mean? It's almost like this is a natural response to having a really difficult condition as an adolescent.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, I agree. And I think someone better versed in mental health might have a better take on it for me. But no, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of I think one of the things that the papers do mention, the adolescent paper particularly, is that actually a lot of the opportunity for mental health in this situation is stuff that can, you know, interventions or support that can help to halt a developing mental health issue or prevent mental health issues developing. So if you can build into, you know, HIV care contacts, appropriate signposting for services or networks or support groups, that can, you know, help adolescents come to terms with an HIV diagnosis and the other factors in their life that might contribute to mental ill health, you could actually, you know, stop a more serious mental health problem developing. And I think that's one of the things that the paper does highlight.
it often feels like the capacity for mental health services is quite limited to people going through kind of the more acute episodes of mental health issues. So is accessibility a major issue when we're talking about people with HIV accessing mental health services? And of course, you mentioned as well the difficult to reach populations, the stigmatization that might stop people coming forward, those sort of issues must be tied in with it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, stigma and discrimination are, as I mentioned, huge barriers to care for some populations. You know, if your identity or behavior is criminalized, you may be very reticent to seek support for that, or even to seek, you know, you might be concerned that an HIV diagnosis will reveal to people that, you know, or people might assume from an HIV diagnosis that you... that, you know, you belong to a population that's stigmatized, and so you might be reticent to seek care. But also, I mean, on a more basic level, I guess, in resource limited settings, you know, mental health provision is seriously lacking. One of the things that's really been a great benefit to HIV is sort of international financial support for HIV programs. And there's, you know, HIV programs have developed a lot of health infrastructure in some resource limited settings. So really there's potential to make a big difference through integration of HIV and mental health services. You know, at the bare minimum, just training people who are providing HIV care through sort of, you know, donor supported systems to be aware of the signs of mental ill health. And as I said previously, to signpost to appropriate support could be a great first step. So yeah, in resource limited settings, community and peer support can be a great help for people experiencing emotional distress, and helping people entering HIV care to make links to peer support and community networks might help to halt the development of or to prevent mental health issues, as I said previously. So we think that the papers also make a really strong case for HIV programs to include funding and support for mental health services. And that's, you know, whether the programs are funded nationally or by international donor organizations.
So what does this kind of better integration look like? You talked about it in resource limited settings there, but for instance, in the UK, what could be done better?
Yeah, I think in the first instance, it really just require training people in both specialties to be aware of the potential of co-occurrence of HIV and mental ill health. And also then to, you know, training them to provide appropriate signposting and appropriate care where possible. There's also a case for much closer integration. So there's a couple of examples in the paper on substance users. These examples from Spain, so that services addressing the psychiatric need of, you know, substance misuse, they have HIV care embedded in them. So so they'll have, as well as the psychiatric and psychological care, they'll have an infectious diseases specialist who can test for HIV or who can and other illnesses, but also people accessing these services could be initiated on treatment if needed, or receive adherence counselling if that's something that they're struggling with. And now, of course, there's no blueprint for this, and there's not one size fits all. I think the papers highlight that while there are sort of, you know, good examples of things dotted about and stuff could, and, you know, there's lots of things to be learned from, there's also not a great evidence base to support these sorts of interventions. But also, you know, each population, each setting is so different in terms of healthcare needs and healthcare capacity that although there are sort of common factors and common ideas that would underpin this integration or alignment, really does need to be tailored locally and to the population being considered. And mental health care in particular really needs to be adapted to local contexts. But as I say, I think these papers really make a great case for HIV programs to recognise mental health needs.
So sort of in summary, it's better to add mental health services to systems that already exist to reach these populations rather than kind of a more generalised mental health for people with HIV service.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's not, don't need to reinvent the wheel. It's just about making sure that, that the appropriate services are available for the populations that need them. And there is an opportunity to do that where there are existing HIV services, but also actually, I mean, you know, particularly in resource-limited settings, as I mentioned, there's HIV services exist and you add mental health in there. But actually, in better resource settings or settings with stronger mental health infrastructure, training people within that to recognize signs of HIV risk or ways to approach, sort of bring HIV management into mental health services, just because there is this co-occurrence of these two conditions, and people could really benefit from, you know, people in both specialty thinking about the other.
I wanted to finish up by talking kind of more generally. You know, editor-in-chief of The Lancet HIV, you see all the cutting-edge research about HIV coming through. What's the current state of HIV treatment? You know, sometimes you hear rumblings about vaccines. Obviously, PrEP has been a bit of a game changer recently. What's the kind of state of play at the moment?
I mean, it's a really encouraging situation, I think. I think of about 38 million people estimated to be living with HIV worldwide, 28 million people are on treatment. And that's incredible. Almost impossible to imagine, over a decade ago or whatever. In 2010, fewer than 8 million people worldwide were receiving treatment.
Wow, that's a huge change. Like, what's been the kind of driver behind that change over the last 10 years?
Access to affordable medications, systems to provide, drugs at an affordable price to low resource settings that have the highest burden of HIV. The health system set up to treat people with HIV, and just a really concerted effort. It's recognition that, there isn't a vaccine, there isn't a cure. The way to stop people, the way to save lives of people living with HIV is to treat them, and also treatment blocks transmission. If someone is on treatment and their virus is suppressed, they cannot pass on HIV. So getting people on treatment is one of the most effective ways to prevent HIV. Over the course of the past 10, 15 years, drugs have improved. They have fewer side effects. They're simpler to take. So you can, instead of huge pill burden daily, now for a lot of people, it's just one or two pills a day to control HIV. It's a really great success story. Now, there are still a lot of people living with HIV who aren't on treatment, and that needs to be addressed. But that's a matter of finding those people, diagnosing those people. And that's, again, about, access to care, access to diagnostics. It's a really positive thing. And as you say, you mentioned PrEP, which is having a great impact on people who don't have HIV, taking a pill a day or, managing sort of their PrEP use around periods of potential risk of HIV exposure. Yeah, that's making a huge difference and helping to bring down numbers of new infections. It's a really great story. And there's also, there are vaccines that people are trialing, and there's interest in sort of using mRNA vaccines after the experience of COVID and seeing whether there's any possibility there. But HIV is still proving somewhat intractable to vaccines, and we've had some recent disappointments in a vaccine trial. But on the treatment side, also, there's now long-acting injectable treatments, which means, you can give people an injection once every month, once every 8 weeks, and that's enough to keep the virus suppressed. Now, some people might prefer a daily pill to the injections or whatever, but it's great to have diversifying options in terms of treatment, a range of different drugs, a range of different, routines of taking drugs, so that people can really find the treatment that suits them. And that's the same for prevention as well, with there's PrEP, but there's also, you can use the long-acting injectable drugs as PrEP as well. So some people might stick to daily pill taking, some people might get the injections. There's the microbicidal rings, which can help women to manage their HIV risk. So these diverse options, it's really encouraging. I think it's quite a positive time for HIV treatment and prevention.
Do you think, I guess you've been editor-in-chief of The Lancet HIV for a good few years now. Would you have been happy with this point? You know, if you kind of, someone had said to you in 2022, this is what the HIV outlook would look like, would you have been, that's a positive kind of success story, or?
I think it's a trajectory one might have been able to predict in a way. I don't think there's, there was, when Lancet HIV was started, there was already this great commitment. Drugs were becoming more accessible. Shortly after we launched, policy was changed to, instead of waiting for people's CD4 count to drop to a certain level before you start treatment, recognizing that treatment is really effective as prevention. Shortly after the Lancet HIV launched, the global recommendation for instant treatment upon diagnosis of HIV came in. So I think it's a great situation, as I said. You know, it's a real success story, slightly predictable. It's such, you know, it would be great if there had been in the period that the journal's been going, a cure or a vaccine, a real sort of game changer like that. But there hasn't been. But, you know, the situation we're in now is really testimony to the hard work of people all over the world doing the groundwork, getting people diagnosed, getting people on treatment, and really maximising the diversification in treatment, new modalities, and diversification in prevention as well.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Pete. This has been fantastic. I've really enjoyed it. It's really good to have this kind of overview of HIV, as well as talk about, you know, the mental health aspects of the series. And hopefully we can drive a few people to read the series as well.
Yeah, I would really encourage everyone to. There, you know, it's three great series papers, really thought provoking, and hopefully, you know, inspiring some meaningful change. So, thank you very much for giving me the chance to speak to you about them.
That's it for this episode of The Lancet Voice. If you want to carry on the conversation, you can find Jessamy and I on Twitter, on our handles @GavinCleaver and @JessamyBagginal. You can subscribe to The Lancet Voice, if you're not already, wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you're a specialist in a particular field, why not check out our In Conversation With series of podcasts, tied to each of The Lancet specialty journals, where we look in-depth at one new article per month. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you again next time.